نعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي امري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي اعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على اشرف الانبياء والمرسلين خاتم النبيين شفيع المذنبين رحمة للعالمين مولانا وسيدنا ابي القاسم محمد وعلى اله السيدين الطاهرين المعصومين المنتجبين المظلومين الهداة المهديين لا سيما بقيه الله في الارض ارواحنا له الفداء ولعنه الله على اعدائهم اجمعين من الان الى قيام يوم الدين اما بعد فقد قال ابو عبد الله الامام الحسين بن علي عليه الصلاه والسلام
اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد
الناس عبيد الدنيا والدين لعب على السنتهم يحوسونه ما درت معايشهم فاذا محسوا بالبلاء قلت ديانون پر محمد وعلى محمد صلوات
اللهم صل على
Respected elders, brothers, sisters, salamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is our fifth lecture in this series of lectures looking at the values that we have, looking at defining the values that we should have, relating it to the will of our first imam, looking at some concepts for our life. Alhamdulillah, we've covered many things and you guys have appreciated it. May Allah bless you. Tonight we discuss something that we often discuss regarding the world, dunya. Almost every ashra there's some mention of dunya. Tonight what I want to do is I want to concentrate on not the abuse of dunya, but rather, let's be smart about our dunya. Let us use our dunya in a way that it can help with our akhirah as well. Now, dunya, is it important or not important? On one hand, we hear very often from scholars, God bless them, that dunya is not important. Don't bother with it. Don't worry about it. On one hand, that is absolutely correct. On another hand, we've seen in the first two lectures, which were about death and barzakh, it is fundamentally important. Why? Because although it forms a very small part of our everlasting life, it's only a short time compared to the eternity we are going to spend in akhirat and the long time we are going to spend in barzakh. Relatively it's short, but it is so important and so fundamental that everything we then pick up in barzakh and akhirat is a result of what we build over here. There is a little bit of room for the grace of God to come into barzakh and akhirat. There is the area of his mercy. There is the aspect of sawab jari, but by and large, it is heavily, largely dependent upon what we do in the 60, 70, 80 years if Allah gives us that much time. So on one hand, it is not important from the point of view of materialism and these kind of things. But on the other hand, what we build here is fundamentally important. We want salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So the lecture title tonight is how to succeed in the world without jeopardizing the hereafter. Is it either world or hereafter? Can it be world and hereafter? This is what we're going to discuss. So you'll see with a few simple techniques and a few simple attitudes and values, we can't make it world as hereafter. In fact, that's how it should be. That is how it should be. These two things of world and hereafter, they are made by the same being. They are governed by the same spiritual laws. So in fact, it should be dunya and akhirah. We'll discuss how. Ayatollah Mihbar Yazdi, may Allah grant him a long life, he presents it in the following way. He says there are two ways of looking at the world. One is animalistic and one is human. The first one, as the animalistic way of looking at the world, he calls it dunya hadafi, meaning that you make your hadaf, your aim, your objective, dunya. In other words, you're here and the world is an end for you. It's your goal, it's your objective, it's your aim. So what is the kind of animalistic way of looking at the world? For example, a person lives his life in the following way. He's hungry, he eats. He's thirsty, he drinks. He's tired, he sleeps. He has lustful desires, he fulfills them. He becomes angry, he lashes out. He feels threatened, he hits. He feels angry, he fights. He goes to sleep, he wakes up the next day, pretty much the same thing. Maybe in there somewhere he's sitting in a namaz. Maybe if it's the month of Ramadan, he's fasting. Maybe somewhere along the line he'll shed a tear for Imam Hussein. Maybe he'll do a few more good deeds. But overall, his attitude and approach to the world is animalistic. He is dunya hadafi. His hadaf, his maqsad, his objective is dunya. Then we have the human way of looking at dunya. Human way is what Ayatollah Mihbar says. It is dunya guzari, meaning you guzar, you pass by the world. You use it as a place of passing by. It's not a permanent place. It's not your goal. It's not your objective. You actually accurately place the world in the hierarchy of the structure of the universe. Let me not get too complicated. You recognize it for what it is. You recognize that you have to be here in order to build your next life. So what do? You live as cleanly, purely, successfully as possible. However, in the front of your mind, you are perfectly aware that this is not my goal. This is my means to a goal. I'm not here to stay. I'm passing by. I'm like a traveler in this place. I'm going somewhere else. This is just for me to pass through briefly. And while I'm here, I do as much as I can to prepare for my ongoing journey. With one salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
The analogy I would like you to think about is, let's say you're in a plane, you're in an aircraft, you're traveling. The plane has taken off. You're sitting in your seat. You open your eyes, you look around. You'll see two things. Number one is your immediate view. What is your immediate view? You have a seat, you have another seat in front of you, you have people around you, some are eating, some are drinking, some are walking around, someone's in the bathroom, people are talking, someone is reading, someone is sleeping. That's your immediate view, that's your immediate world. However, as soon as you open the blind and look out the window, wow, it's another world altogether. You realize that actually this plane, although on the inside it looks very big and very long, as if it's loads of people, maybe 500, 600 people in a plane. But actually, in the grand scheme of things, it's very small. There is a world above, there is a world below. Things are in perspective, I understand. What else happens in a plane? Number one, you have no power over stopping the plane. You can't tell the pilot, can you just stop and let me off here and then pick me up later? You can't do that. You have no power over the plane. You have no power over the direction of the plane. It's going. You can't ask it to stop and to wait while you get ready. So the world is like this. It's going. It's going at a frantic pace. Our lives are going really quickly. But we somehow have been caught up in it. And we are still confined to that small, narrow view of the plane. We haven't understood sometimes the larger picture of where this plane is. Where does this world rest within the cosmos of the creation of Allah SWT? So inshallah today, we want to look at that kind of concept in a bit more depth. So the value which we extract here, the value is to see the world as a place of passing by and not as a place of permanence. That is the value. If we can instill that value into us, into our minds, then it's a big achievement. To keep telling yourself, to keep explaining to yourself, I'm only passing through. I'm not here to stay. You've not been created for this place. You've been created for a much grander, amazing place. We want salawat ala Muhammad wa ala
Muhammad.
So now, that's the premise. Now let's go into some detailed discussion. First question. Do you think the people in Karbala, alongside Imam Hussein, some were his family, some were his sons, some were his brothers, like Hazrat Abbas, and some were his ashab, some came with him from Medina, some joined in Makkah, some joined in the journey, some joined right on Karbala. The question I want to ask is, were they there by coincidence or not by coincidence? Was it, for example, someone was riding through the desert and saw, oh my God, here's Imam Hussein, he's in trouble, let me help him? Was it like that? So here, you would say no. None of them who were there in Karbala on the side of Haqq, on the side of truth, none of that was coincidental. Each and every one of them was there because somewhere along the line, they had made the right decision. So in life, there are a number of critical decisions which come along. With one salawat, please, ala Muhammad wa ala
Muhammad.
On a daily basis, we go through lots of decisions. Maybe hundreds of all sorts of small and mundane decisions. However, at milestones in our life, we will come across a few critical decisions. Critical, very momentous, very important decisions. Like what? Like, for example, what to study. Big decision. What profession to go into. Big, big decision. Going to impact the rest of your life, probably. What kind of very close friends to have. Big decision. It can shape a person's youth. That youth will change and shape his adulthood. Whom to marry? Big, big decision, isn't it? When to marry? Massive decision. We are really playing with fire the more we delay that decision of marriage. These are massive decisions. Times will come in your life, you'll be faced with a decision, do I do this or that? And we need to be prepared. If we are not prepared for those momentous decisions, our life can take a very bad turn indeed. And we see it in Karbala. People had the opportunity to accompany Imam Hussein. People, some of them, Imam himself approached. I don't have time to go into detail, but I'm sure you remember the story of Abdullah al-Juhri. When Imam goes to him, Imam actually walks over to him and invites him and says, join me. And he says, I'm not going to come because I've got my own life, but here's my horse and here's my sword. Imam says, I don't want them. I think for you, if you're not coming, I don't want anything else. So he failed. And other people succeeded. Now, what makes a person take the right decision? When we are confronted with these things, should I do this or should I do that? What makes us take the right decision? This is what we're going to look into with a salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. There are a few theories. One theory is that in order to take the right decision at the right time, you should have knowledge, ilm. I don't agree fully. It's definitely a helping factor, but it's not the full factor. Why? Look at Karbala once again. Were there people on the side of Yazid who had knowledge? Were there people there who knew what they were doing? Definitely. The commander of the army himself, Umar Asad, and Allah cursed him, he himself was toying with the idea of switching sides until the last moment. He had a debate with him. It's all recorded in history. He was talking to himself, similar to what we discussed about Hur yesterday. He was talking to himself, he was asking himself questions. Finally he said, do I want Akhirat, which is very far away, or do I want the government of Ray, which is immediate? And he said, I'll think about the Akhirat later, this is now in my hands, let me take it. He knew what he was doing. All of them, probably, if not the vast majority of them, knew what they were doing. So ilm is not the complete factor in making the right decision. Second, what about someone who would say, it depends on your background, your parents, your grandparents, how good they were. Again, in Karbala, you see very, very noble, so-called noble people on the side of Yazid. So that's not a factor. It may be a contributing factor, but it's not the total factor. In this regard, we are given the answer by Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam himself with one salawat. Imam stands in front of the forces of Yazid and says, you are not able to understand and hear what I'm saying because of the haram sustenance in your stomach. Haram sustenance, haram risk, is one of those obstacles to making the right decision. Honestly, it clouds the mind. It clouds the soul. Now, if you retrace the steps, what leads to haram risk, then really it gets frightening. And it should be. And we should retrace the steps. How we earn, what we do to earn, the processes involved in earning. Are we truthful? Are we transparent? Are we honest? Is a little white lie slipping here and there? Is a little con happening here and there? Are we totally whiter than white in our dealings? That all has an impact upon this risk element. The extreme case was in Karbala, Umar Asad, no, Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad had given people bribes. He bought them. He said, here's a bunch of money, take it and fight on my side. So they did. But there are subtler forms of haram risk. Now, I want to extend that idea of haram risk one stage further with a salawat be ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. It's not only haram risk. Haram risk is a representative of what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is sins in general. Haram risk is one of those. It's a bad one, but it's just one of those. Sins in general will cloud your decision-making process. It will not allow you to make the right decision. And that again comes down to the way we see the world. A quick narration from the glorious life of our beloved Messenger Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. The Holy Prophet took a number of his companions and went on a journey. They decided to rest for the evening. It happened to be a desert. In a desert, things don't grow. You don't find anything like trees and plants. He said to his companions, "Go and gather some wood so we can make a fire." The companion said, "Ya Rasulullah, this is a desert. We're not going to find any wood or any of these things." He said, "Go and look carefully and dig around and look around and you'll find something." So they go. Each person spent, you know, good amount of time. Each one of them brought back a few twigs, little bit of a branch, small amount. And they all came and put it down in front of the Holy Prophet. This small amount ended up in a big pile of wood. Rasulullah said, "In this way, our unaware sins gather ready to show Allah on the Day of Judgment." We don't know sometimes we're sinning. We don't know sometimes the impact which is happening upon our hearts by the world around us. Things you hear, things you see, it's all having an impact whether you like it or not sometimes. So where is all this being stored? We said already in the first two lectures, it's being stored over here in your soul. This is why, in order to make right decisions, good decisions, decisions which are going to pay off in the long run, I highly advise, I don't advise, so mean highly advise, that we engage in istighfar, tawbah, asking for forgiveness. So what you do, you set a small amount of time, maybe 2 or 3 minutes, maybe 5 minutes. If you're that busy, 1 minute a day at a time when you choose. Could be after a particular namaz, could be in the morning before you leave home, could be at night before you go to sleep, could be at a particular moment of the day where you think you have a minute to spare, and start to review your day. What have I done? In the last 24 hours, what have I done? Review. Every sin you can think of, and inshallah, these sins reduce as time goes on, but every sin you think of, ask Allah for forgiveness. Say Astaghfirullah. Say it in any language you want, it doesn't really matter. If you can cry, all the better. Crying over sins is an excellent way of getting them forgiven. And then you keep doing that. What the ulama say is that you also include a bunch of istighfar and tawbah for things that you can't remember, because we are sometimes doing things that we are even unaware of. So implement that in your life. Keep some time on a daily basis to ask Allah for forgiveness. Inshallah, He forgives us all. We want salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Now this is when we do sin, guna. However, there's another worse situation than this. Sometimes we become so habituated, it becomes such an adat for us to do guna, that those gunas add up and they form a habit. And then sometimes, na'udhubillah, God forbid, we are doing those things without even realizing. It's just become a way of life. Now what to do in this situation? This requires a little bit more specialist treatment. So I'm going to propose 3 steps that we deal with these sinful habits when guna becomes a habit. With one salawat, Jigala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Step number one is to take small efforts to to punish yourself against that sin. A story will highlight this better. A politician goes to a wise man and says, I want you to help me. He says, sure, what's the problem? He says, in the course of my work, I feel very proud. Politicians, they have power, they can direct lots of things. So he says, I feel very arrogant, I feel very proud. Tell me something to do. He said, okay, he said, this pride is something very deep. Maybe we can't remove it in one go. It has to be slowly, maybe. He said, as a first instance, I want you to go outside where you see lots of shoes of people and go and straighten them all out. Put them all nicely, pick them up with your hands. No wearing gloves, none of this stuff. Pick them up with your hands and put them all nicely in a row, arrange them, and then we'll talk more. So that's what his initial elaj, medicine, cure was for pride. So sometimes we need to take these kinds of steps. Someone with a temper will have to do something to force himself to calm down. Someone with a bad akhlaq, always lashing out, always angry, will have to do something to calm that sin. Again, it was either Aga Bulu Jardi or Aga Mar Ashi Najdi. May Allah bless all of our ulama who had the following incident in his life. One of them, I can't remember. I think it must have been Aga Bulu Jardi. He had apparently he felt he had an anger problem. He would react harshly to his students. And he knew this. So he tried and tried and tried to stop this. Eventually it wasn't happening. He said to himself, the next time I get angry at someone, I'm going to fast. Now, ulama usually they fast a lot. They said it's going to be something momentous. He said to himself, he made a vow to God that the next time I display anger, I will fast for 1 year. For 1 year, apart from the days which are obviously haram to fast, I'm going to fast for a year. He got angry and he had to fast. It was a vow. He had to do it. Do you think he was angry after that? I doubt it. So it requires sometimes these self-inflicted cures. If we are really bothered about our vices, it requires these cures as a first step in order to overcome these vices. Now, we come on to the second step in how to cure vices. With a salawat, please, ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. The second solution is something which I want to say, and believe me, hand on heart, this is not applying to anyone here. But because humans are humans everywhere, I recommend these things also exist here. Allahu A'lam. Allah knows better. These are some of the things that picked up on my travels and in my very limited, humble experience. So, I meet people. And one thing which I've noticed is that some people have the habit that they will sin, and then what they do, and sometimes it's quite funny, what they do is they make up excuses for themselves in their sin. Now, sometimes it's difficult for me to hear these things and keep a straight face. So I'll give you one example. A lady once said to me, she said that for some reason I cannot bear to recite my Namaz-e-Fajr. My Namaz-e-Fajr gets qaza every day. Now number one, she shouldn't even be telling me this. Number one. So I advised her, I said, look, you shouldn't really be telling me this. But she said, no, I want you to hear me out. तो मैं नमाज कैसे कर रहा
हूं ओके मैं नमाज कैसे कर रहा
हूं एंड देन शी सेड समथिंग वेरी फनी शी सेड इट गेट्स कर रहा आई कांट बी बॉदर टू गेट अप बाथरूम वजू खाम मुसल्ला प्रे आई कांट बी बॉदर बट अल्लाह इज नॉट गोइंग टू पनिश मी आई सेड हाउ कम शी सेड बिकॉज मेरी हाजिरी लग जाती है I said, can you explain, please? She said, in the divine register of Allah, meri hazri lag jati hai. I'm marked as present, not absent. And he's not going to punish me. I said, okay, can you explain? I'm like, how? She said, what I do is, at the time of Fajr, I sit up in my bed with my blanket on me. I take my tasbih. I'm half asleep, half awake, and I do some subhanallah, the astaghfirullah, this, that, and I know he's so kind and merciful, ke meri hazri lag jati hai. I am marked as present. And I know he's not going to punish me. I said, subhanallah, you know a Lord which even the Holy Prophet didn't know this Lord. Even Quran doesn't speak about this Lord. This Lord is an amazing self-creation of yours. We make excuses to kind of make ourselves feel better. Now that was a slightly humorous, but it happened. It happens alarmingly. Let me tell you one or two more. Some people say, I do this thing, but Allah is not that cruel that He will punish me. He's merciful. We don't understand that sometimes punishment is a mercy. Not sometimes, every time. His punishment is actually a mercy. Because He has given you so many chances, so many opportunities, so much guidance, that the only way to purify you and bring you back on the right path is to punish you. It's a mercy itself. But we live in this world, this fantasy world, He's not going to punish me. Another thing that we do, another one of these excuses, with a salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala
Muhammad.
Another one of these excuses, and this is like a classic. This one I hear a lot. So, on a number of occasions, sisters who don't observe hijab. Now, of course, there are as many male examples as female ones, but this is just coming to mind. Sisters who don't wear hijab. So they will say things like, I know I don't wear hijab, but at least I don't backbite. Whereas other people wear hijab and backbite. I say to them, these are two different things. So what? If someone wears hijab and backbite, she shouldn't. And so what if you don't wear and you don't backbite, you should wear. These are two separate things. We shouldn't be thinking like this. It doesn't make sense. These are two different laws. It's like saying, oh, you know, I steal, but at least I don't murder. It doesn't make sense. These are two different crimes in the eyes of Allah. Let's not make silly excuses for ourselves. And the best one, this is the one I like the most. I do this thing, even I've seen Maulanas and Mulyanis do this thing. Wow. So what? If they do it, so what? That doesn't excuse anyone. If they do it, they are going to meet their own creator and have to answer for their own deeds. That doesn't excuse anyone. The only group of people that are absolutely hujjat for us and we can emulate anything they did are the 14 masumin. Apart from that, we don't have hujjat in any human. We cannot emulate any human and say, this is a divine human, except for 14 masumin. Otherwise, who cares? Whoever does the thing, they are not hujjat for us. They should be doing it. Fine, go and tell them. Do your Amr bil Ma'ruf, do your Nahi al-Munkar, But don't say they do it, so it's okay for me to do it. So the second step of the solution was, don't make these flimsy excuses. With one salawat ala Muhammad wa ala
Muhammad.
The third solution, and this is probably the deepest. This is when we come over steps one and two. This is where it requires some self-reflection, some introspection, examination of the self. What you'll find is basically every sin or vice is connected to a psychological reality. For example, an arrogant and proud person is arrogant and proud to cover his own feeling of inferiority. He feels somewhere in there, maybe he was bullied as a kid, maybe he was abused as a child. He feels somewhere in there that I'm inferior. So I need to show that I'm very superior. And so he tries to dominate other people. People who are stubborn, they probably think they are more wise than anyone else. It's a psychological condition. Someone who is a miser, doesn't want to give. Maybe he thinks by giving, his amount will be reduced. He doesn't understand that he's depositing good deeds for the life hereafter. It's an investment in the life hereafter. He thinks, oh, but my money is reducing. Someone who doesn't pray, doesn't think that Allah's worship is important. All of these vices are connected to some kind of psychological condition. The third step is to trace those roots and deal with it at the root. Why do I find it difficult to rely on Allah? Why is my sabr so little? Why am I this way in front of people? Why do I think I have an addiction to these few luxuries and attachments? It requires a lot of depth and research, and then you can address these things with one salawat ala Muhammad wa ala
Muhammad.
There's a hadith which is from our first Imam, Imam Ali alayhi salatu wa salam. Who's given a very good way of addressing some of these issues with a practical point. He says, the sadaqa given in a hidden way that no one knows about it is very good for removing sins. We're talking about sins, right? Making good decisions is helped by not having sin. Giving sadaqa, giving to good causes, is an excellent way of washing away the sins. Namaz is another one. Sila Rahim is a fantastic one. Joining with your family, maybe patching up differences, coming to peace, keeping contact, these things are very, very powerful for your soul. Inshallah, Allah give us tawfiq. Now, the world, dunya, how do we deal with it with more effectiveness? So the world, the way it behaves with us, is primarily shaitan comes in. Our nafs is also a part of this equation. The nature of the world can also be a part of this equation. The world uses two weapons in order to trap us. Fundamentally, two ways the world traps us. Number one, greed. Number two, fear. Greed and fear. Greed in what way? He has something, I want it. I will do anything to get that thing. Fear in what way? I have this thing, no one else should have it. I don't want to lose it. These are the two key weapons of shaitan. Greed and fear. With the salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. This is being fueled, this greed and fear attitude is being fueled at the moment by my favorite subject, social media. You remember me as a Maulana who didn't like social media. So social media has fantastic benefits, undoubtedly. For example, business links. For example, advertising, marketing is fantastic. For example, on a social level, if you want to raise awareness of an issue, a problem, a scandal, something to do with truth and batil, haq and batil, you can use social media, you can reach millions of people within minutes. It's a fantastic tool when used wisely, undoubtedly. However, when used to fuel these things, greed and fear, it's very destructive. I will talk a bit more about it when you come on to societal pressures, which is the next one. Briefly, at the moment, what am I talking about? What happens on social media typically is, for example, someone is experiencing happiness. Alhamdulillah. Wonderful. If a mu'min is happy, we are all happy, isn't it? Someone is experiencing happiness. Now, that happiness is between them, their loved ones, and their Lord. Great. What we have found is, for some reason, there are ideas, but I don't want to go into them. We want to show that happiness to other people. This is where it gets a little bit complicated. We want to show that happiness, okay. So we will put comments, we'll put emojis, we'll put graphics, we'll put photos, we'll put tags, we'll put all sorts. And then it starts to become a competition among some people. They'll put more explicit photos, someone else will put a more explicit photo, someone else will put a more explicit photo to show, mashallah, how happy we are that we have to show in this way. That's one. Number two, hijab is compromised. Whichever way you look at it, it's hard to justify some of those pictures out there. I'm really sorry, hand on heart, I'm not wanting to offend anyone, and I don't know about anyone's social media account here, but in general, it's hard to justify some of these pictures. Whichever marja you follow, whichever those new masail you want to hold in your hand, it's going to be very hard to justify some of these pictures. Now, where does greed come into it? Where does fear come into it? With one salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Greed. I see the picture, I become envious. Maybe not even jealous. You know the difference between jealousy and envy. Jealousy is a negative trait. You see someone who has something that they deserve and you want them not to have it. That's jealousy. Envy is not necessarily negative. Envy is, you have something good, I don't mind if you have it, I want it as well. Principally, there's nothing wrong with that. So you can start with envy. Oh, he's so happy. Why am I not that happy? Oh, he looks so wonderfully happy with his family, his wife, his kids. Why is my wife not like that? Why are my kids not like that? What is it fueling me? Resentment, disappointment, depression, anxiety, inferiority, don't feel good, don't like to mix with other people, feeling grumpy, feeling angry, life has dealt me a bad hand, I have married the wrong person, I've got bad kids. It becomes a cycle of negativity. Why? Fueled by greed. I want that, I want that, I want that. But I don't have it. So I'll suffer. I'll suffer inside myself. I'll burn myself inside. Now, where does fear come into it? Well, I'm so happy that what I have, I don't want to lose. So I will keep putting more and more things out there to keep this image of me being super happy. One birthday party is not enough. I'll put the next 10 years' birthday party. One holiday is not enough. Every holiday must be there. One meal in a restaurant is not enough. I need to show people what I'm having for breakfast as well the next day. It doesn't end. Greed and fear. Now the things I'm talking about, the examples I'm giving are extreme because I have to give extreme examples to make the point. Now people may say, well, we're not at that level. Okay, you're not at that level, alhamdulillah. But have you thought about what your actions are having on someone who suffers from inferiority? Islam is a social religion. We should never say, well, this is me and my amal, I'm okay. No. Your amal may be having an effect on someone else's life. You need to consider that. You need to think it through. You need to establish whether that's the case or not. Can I leave you with one sentence which is a golden nugget? Inshallah, if you don't remember much from these lectures, I hope you remember this one sentence. With one, La salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Many people spend money they don't have to buy things they don't need to impress people they don't know. That is a sad reality of our time. Too many people spend money they don't have, they go into debt, they borrow on things they don't need, in fact, to impress people they don't know. That's the reality of our time. We pray to Allah to protect us from this, to keep our youth focused on what they should be focused on, to remove the evil from these very useful tools, and we make use of them properly in the way of truth, inshallah. With one salawat ala Muhammad wa ala. In this discussion, the power of Imam Hussein must be mentioned. Why is he so powerful in this discussion particularly? Imam Hussein basically changed the rules of the games. When you come to Madras, when you hear his history, when you hear his masail, it tells us this man did play by these rules. He changed the rules. He showed the world isn't worth that much when confronted with oppression, when confronted with dishonesty. He showed even the lives of his loved ones were not worth as much as truth, freedom, honesty, dignity, honor. He showed not only his Yazid evil, but he has trained us to not only hate Yazid, but to hate Yazidiyat. Everything to do with that man is hated. Otherwise, he's in history, he's gone. We remember him with a lot of ill feeling and hatred, and we curse him. Why? Because he stood for something horrible. So we hate Yazid, we hate Yazidiyat. We love Hussein, we love Husseiniyat. Everything that he stood for, we love. This was the power, this is the power of Imam Hussein. He makes us realize worldly people, worldliness is wrong. Akhirat and the people of Akhirat are right. Tonight we remember one such pure individual. Imam is now camped in Karbala. Hur was the one responsible for driving Imam into the plains of Karbala. What then started to happen is that the message went out to all the different places, to to all the different commanders of Yazid forces, and each commander had under him a battalion of soldiers. So the word went out, get your battalion and go to Karbala. Slowly and surely, the battalion of Hurmala arrived, the battalion of Shimr arrived, Umar ibn Sa'd and his forces arrived. So slowly and surely, this group is getting bigger and bigger. Imam Hussein's forces look smaller and smaller. Janazeh Zainab comes to her brother. She says, my brother, as I look over there, the enemies are increasing in their thousands. We have only a few with us. Let us reach out. Let us think. Is there anyone we can reach out to? She begins to think. She begins to look back in history. At one point she says, oh brother, someone is coming to my mind. Imam says, who? She says, I remember when you were very young, there was an older youth, an older boy. He would follow you around with such care and devotion. I remember you fell, he would pick you up. I remember whatever you needed, he would get it for you. His name was Habib. Brother, send message to Habib. He is the type of person that will answer our call. Imam agrees. Imam dispatches a rider with a letter from himself towards Kufa. Habib is stationed in Kufa. Imam sends a messenger. The messenger arrives at the house of Habib. He hands him the letter. Habib, when he sees that it is from Hussein, lifts it, puts it to his eyes, kisses the letter and starts to read. The letter, some have said, was as follows. From Hussein the Ghareeb in Karbala to his dear friend Habib. He addresses Habib in this way. When Habib begins to read the letter, tears start to flow from his eyes. The wife of Habib asks, what is this letter that you are in receipt of? Habib explains, this is from my dear friend Hussein. This is from my Mawla Hussein. He is stationed alone in Karbala. He has reached out to me to help him. I am not sure, should I go? How can I leave you? The wife of Habib says, this is an invitation from the grandson of Rasulullah. His mother was Janabe Fatima. You cannot deny this invitation, she encourages him. He tells his servant, go and make my horse ready, prepare my provisions. I am about to ride from Kufa. The slave does as he is asked. Habib comes to the horse and says to the slave, you are now free. I free you of your bond with me. The slave says, Mawla, let me ask you, where do you ride to? He says, I go to Karbala. The slave says, why do you go to Karbala? He says, my friend Hussein is in need. The slave says, Mawla, this is not justice upon me. All your life you kept me with you. At this amazing moment and this opportunity you sent me away, I will come with you. Habib says, if you come, then you come as a free man. You do not come as my slave. The slave says, of course I will come as a free man. This is an honor for me. Habib ibn Mazahir rides out of Kufa and he rides into Karbala. At one point, on the arrival of Habib, all of the Ahlul Bayt see Habib, they recognize him, they are happy. This noise and this commotion reaches the tent of Janabe Zainab. She says to Bibi Fizza, she says, Fizza, my auntie Fizza, go and see what is this noise. Fizza looks out. She says, Bibi, this is a good moment. Habib has arrived. Bibi laid a tent. What an amazing time. Go and send my salam to this dear Habib. such, Habib joins the forces of Imam. People's energies are lifted. They are somewhat energized by the arrival of Habib. Habib gives a number of speeches. There are a number of sayings of Habib pledging his loyalty to Imam Hussein. And then we come to that fateful day of Ashura. Habib, at one moment, he comes to Imam. He says, Abba Abdullah, I wish to request you for something. I don't know what would be the situation of Imam Hussein's heart when he knew what was coming from his friend. He says, Habib, ask me. Habib says, O Mawla, will you grant me permission to go and fight for you? Imam says, Habib, how can I grant such a thing? After a lot of emphasis and insistence, Imam grants the permission to Habib. Habib goes out. He begins to fight. At one point, they say that he killed many of the enemies. But slowly and surely, this old Habib, this elderly man in Karbala, he begins to lose his energy. The thirst is now hitting him. The heat of the day is now hitting him. On one point, he falls down and he cries out, Adhikini, Ya Abdullah, Imam, come to me. Let me see you for one last time before I leave this world. Imam rushes to Habib. They farewell to each other. After Karbala is done, they say that Habib, his body was beheaded by the enemies. The head was put on the spear. The spear was taken to Kufa. As the spear enters Kufa, with the heads of all of the shuhada, one of the heads is the head of Habib. The son of Habib is still in Kufa. As he looks at and sees the head of his father, he begins to wail and scream and cry, Oh father, oh father. It created such a noise that the forces of Yazid said, Give him his father's head. Let there be no more noise. I ask you, O Abba Abdullah, what was the reaction of Sakina, the Pakistan, when your head was presented to her? And she cried, and she cried to such an extent that she became unconscious. And then when Bibi Zainab came to check, why is this girl not regaining conscious? At one point, Zainab had to say, Inna lillah. فَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْقَلَبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ رَبَّنَا تَقَبَّلْ مِنَّا إِنَّكَ أَنْتَ السَّمِيعُ الْعَلِيمُ فَهُوَ الْمَرْحُومِينَ كَرَّسَ السَّائِحَ الْفَاتِحَةَ